Well, this is your host, Todd Lewis of the Praise of Folly podcast. I am pleased to have Derek Jensen from the Deep Green Resistance on. So, Derek, I first heard about you from an interview. I don't know if the name Keith Preston means anything to you, but he interviewed somebody from the Cascadia Project, Casey Corcoran, about 6 or 7 years ago. And that's where I first heard about Occupied Cascadia, the documentary. And that's where I first heard about you. And also Lier Keith. And a couple of years ago, I had Lier Keith on to talk about veganism. And I was wondering, you know, does she know anybody who would want to talk about more of the ecological side, the more environmental side of your guys' philosophy? And so I was sort of able to get a hold of you, which has been interesting. So why don't you explain how you got involved in the environmental thinking, how you got into the Deep Green Resistance, and just sort of let people know who you are.
Well, probably my introduction to environmentalism was probably in second grade. So when I was 7 or 8, they put in a subdivision near where I lived, and it, you know, converted all of the meadows and pastures and fields to a suburb. And I remember thinking, even as a kid, I mean, I recognized that there were meadowlarks there, and then there weren't meadowlarks there, and there were, you know, anthills and cottonwood trees and various grasses and red-winged blackbirds, and then there weren't. And I remember thinking, this can't go on. I didn't have the language for it. I had that language, but I didn't have this language, that you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. That was pretty much my introduction to understanding that, even at 7, that at some point, you have to have really the only way of living that would be sustainable would be one that can continue, would be one that's not constantly expanding. Excuse me. And so that was sort of the introduction. And then depending on where we want to go with this, I mean, I also write a lot about, abuse, and my father was really abusive. And the key point at this, for this interview right now, is that even as a kid, I was asking myself, if his behavior is making him happy, why is he doing it? And so that sort of set off a lifelong questioning of behaviors that, in some cases, may be destructive, and just asking, gosh, why are they doing it? And what, and we can talk about this with anything. I mean, you know, why did the KKK grow in the late 19th century? And why did the Nazis rise to power? We can talk about this with, you know, whatever group we want. How did they come to commit atrocities? And then the next little part is when I was in high school and then college, I had this sort of habit or hobby or something of asking people if they liked their jobs. And about 90% said no. And so that made me wonder, you know, what are the implications of the vast majority of the people spending the vast majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do? And perhaps more importantly, why would we have an economic system set up such that most people spend most of their time doing things they don't want to do? That really led to the question of who's in charge. And, you know, if we want to get into Lewis Mumford later, we can do that. But the point is that those are some of the strains that formed my later thinking for a lot of my work. And then in my late 20s, I got involved in some environmental, a couple environmental groups, and just really enjoyed working with the people and enjoyed trying to protect. I was living in Spokane, Washington at the time, and so they were really protecting forests of the inland Northwest. Anyway, so that's the short version of of how my the starting points of my various lines of thinking.
All right. One aspect of your theory that you talk about is the problem of growth. No, not just the growth of markets, but also the growth of cities. So you say you define civilization as the growth of cities, and a city is defined as a region or group of people that have consumed all the local resources to the point where they have to import other resources. Would that be a fair articulation of that position?
Yes, and I just want to say that it's great to be interviewed. I mean, I'm delighted that you know my work well enough to know the definition. That's great. So thank you. Yeah.
Oh, no problem. Well, one of the things that I find is interesting is the premise that cities are founded upon violence, because it's sort of an idea that you could say in a sort of a cult sense is always referenced to. So the founding myth of Rome, Romulus murders his brother Remus. The first city as described in the Bible was founded by Cain, who murdered his brother Abel. And we see this trend throughout pagan and Christian and Jewish sources that to some extent there has to be a sacrifice made for the city.
Civilization, and he kills the forest defender and then cuts down the forest to make a city. That's another example.
Well, exactly. And there does seem to be, now the really crux of the issue then is how does the moral order deal with the murder? So for example, in the Roman pagan system, it sort of fed into the idea that the Romans were the sons of Mars and had the right to conquer everyone. And it, within the tradition of Cain and Abel, Cain says, "Am I my brother's keeper?" And the implication throughout the Bible is you are your brother's keeper. And there's a sort of different way of dealing with the moral problem of founding a city. You know, because the murder happens. How do you deal with the murder?
So I have a bunch of directions I can go with this. I'm not sure which one you want. And
whichever one's the most interesting, I guess.
Well, the one that really strikes me is that, unfortunately, or I guess unfortunately shouldn't go at the beginning of the sentence, I feel that, unfortunately, a good portion of our sentience, of our ability to think, is often used to rationalize what we wanted to do in the first place. And Robert J. Lifton wrote extensively about things he called claims to virtue, that before you can commit any mass atrocity, and small atrocity too, you have to convince yourself and others that what you're doing is not in fact an atrocity, but instead something good and noble. So from the perspective of the Nazis, they were not committing mass murder and genocide. They were purifying the Aryan race, and they were doing a tough and dirty job that somebody has to do. And it's regrettable, but it has to be done. And I'm not agreeing with that, of course. I'm saying that that was their perspective. And, you know, the whole Romulus and Remus story, excuse me, is such a great example of, well, we wanted to take it and so we rationalized it. And I mean, I'm not just pointing a finger at them. I mean, I myself in my life have never once been a jerk. Every time that I have ever objectively been a jerk, I have had it fully rationalized.
You know? Well, to interject real quick, this line of thinking, it continues, right? What's the next story in the stage of Romulus? He then engages in the rape of the Sabine women to seed the city of Rome. So it's almost like the original sin of the founding of the city then leads to other, in order to sustain it, you could argue, other problems. And I think what's interesting is at the end of the Bible, in the book of Revelation, the great city of Babylon. It's the destruction of the great city of Babylon that caps the end of the Bible. The great city that buys and sells and conquers and trades, that's destroyed so you can make room for the new. Go ahead, sir.
No, that's great. I was raised a Seventh-day Adventist, and we read the Bible lots, and I know the Bible very well, but honestly, I've never put those stories in the context of cities before. I've never made those connections, so thank you for that.
No problem. One of the things that I kind of wanted to draw out of this conversation is, beginning, as far as I can tell, with Lynn White's 1967 work, the essay where he says the origin of our current ecological crisis, I think it was 67, but he sort of pegs the dominion mandate in Genesis as one of the sort of axiomatic principles undergirding the modern capitalist industrial system. Now, one of the things that I'd like to push back on that a little bit is I think we probably would both agree that the Greek idea of a hierarchy of being, the great chain of being, plays into this. You know, there's rock, and then there's an animal, then there's a man, then there's, you know, these emanations of God until you get to God himself. But if we look at Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, we notice that in the original context in which the dominion mandate was given, killing and eating of animals wasn't really a part of the intended goal. Man is given plants for food, and it's not until Genesis chapter 9 that man is given the authority to eat meat. So at least in its original intention, I think you can make a case that the dominion mandate didn't really even require predation on the part of humans of animals.
So this may not be the direction you want to go, but, and if it's not, then tell me and we'll go a different direction. But something I find really interesting is that a lot of times I am not quite so interested in original intent as I am in tangible effect afterwards. I just had a discussion yesterday with somebody. I really hate the book Lolita, and I think that Lolita is pro-pedophilia and was one of the worst things up until the 1990s, it was one of the, or 1980s, it was one of the worst things in terms of promoting pedophilia. And there are people who argue that it's actually an anti-pedophilia story and everybody's misunderstanding it. Okay, so let's put Lolita aside. I'm going to give like a couple, three examples. The Greed is Good speech from Wall Street, you know, Oliver Stone made Wall Street against the guy who gives the Greed is Good speech is a villain, and we all recognize he's a villain, and he's horrible, and he gives this speech, Greed is Good, it's at one point, and we're supposed to recognize that since he's the villain, we're not supposed to take this directly. But Greed is Good became a catchphrase for Wall Street in the 90s. I am just now, finally, getting around to watching Breaking Bad. And the one reason it took me so long to watch it is because the main character, Walter White, is so nasty. He's got no redeeming features that I can tell at all. And I don't like him. And I found out that that's what the writers intended, that they wanted to give. I mean, we all know the Breaking Bad story, basically. The guy gets cancer. He needs money, so he becomes a meth producer. And what the writers wanted to do, they said, is they wanted to give a guy an excuse, give a person an excuse to do something really evil and then pull out those excuses one by one. He no longer needs the money. He's cured of the cancer. Well, is he going to keep doing it? And he does. And the point is that instead of being viewed as this horrible person, a lot of people perceive Walter White as a hero. And now we're going to go back to Christianity. And do you know about the Homoousians?
You mean, yeah, the debate over the nature of Christ. One nature, a similar nature.
Yeah.
Same nature, a similar nature, yeah.
Exactly. I've never actually met anybody who actually knows about the Homoousian versus the Homoousian conflict of, what was it, 300 current era or 300 AD or whatever?
Around that time, yes.
Yeah, somewhere there. Anyway, it cracked me up that Jesus can profess, he can give this message of love, And within a couple hundred years, people are killing each other in his name. I mean, there were lots and lots of people died in the Homoousian versus Homoousian fights. And my point is that, yes, it may be that the dominion was meant some other way, or it may be that the dominion was meant the way the white guy, what's his name?
Lynn White.
Yeah, Lynn White. The way Lynn White meant it. And my perspective would be, in some ways, it doesn't really matter, because the larger question for me is how it was ultimately interpreted and the effects on it. So it doesn't really matter to me whether Nabokov was trying to promote pedophilia or not. The truth is, it normalized pedophilia and gave us the name Lolita now, which is used in pornography for any, I mean, that's a horrible thing. And so it's, I hear what you're saying, and at the same time, it's really hard. It's really hard as a writer myself to try to write things. I mean, I've had people write to me and say, you know, because of your work, I'm going to go do this and this thing. And I'm like, I never meant that. You know, it's, am I being clear at all? Is this?
I think I know what you're getting at, but let me just paint you a quick picture real quick and tell me what you think about this way of looking at it. So there's a common turn of phrase or a common juxtaposition that many on the left make. Usually those on the left that are trying to make an environmental point, they'll say justice for the poor is tied up in justice for the environment. And one of the things that is a bit interesting is looking at Leviticus 25, where the Jubilee and Sabbath years are given, the association, the language that we use today isn't used, but the association is made. So three things happen. Debts are forgiven, slaves are freed, and the environment, the land is given rest from farming for a year every Sabbath, and every 2 years on the Jubilee, 49th and 50th year. Which is interesting here, because we have within the law a built-in rewilding of portions of the natural world. And when we look at Israel's captivity in Babylon, a very interesting thing is stated in 2 Chronicles 36, 20 to 21. Israel's captivity, its duration, was determined by the amount of Sabbath years they missed in order to give the land rest from their agriculture. And in fact, it says that the land becomes so wild that the beasts devour the people that are left. And so we also have a curious passage in Revelation 11:18, which says God will destroy those who destroy the earth. So I think that if you tie all these together, there's a certain aspect of the Jubilee concept that has built into it, giving the land rest from human use, it's a missed opportunity on both sides.
So I want to just blather on about the Jubilee thing for a second, and then I want to come back and ask you what you mean by missed opportunity.
Okay.
So far as the Jubilee thing, one of the best things, you know, I mentioned a minute ago that I was raised Seventh-day Adventist, and one of the things, there were some things about the religion that were frankly pretty silly, I think. I remember they told us that if you ever go to a movie theater, you're on your own because your guardian angel would not go into the theater because movie theaters are sinful places. And it just seems kind of silly to have all these guardian angels hanging out in the parking lot waiting for you to get out. I mean, there was some stuff like that that was pretty silly. But one of the things that I love, well, two of the things I love. One is it gave me a moral compass. And one of the big problems I think in society today is that, and there are parts of Christianity's moral compass I don't always agree with, but one of the problems that I think has been taking place over the last few hundred years is that with the loss of that moral compass, I don't see, community embracing moral compasses coming up to replace it. What I see is, well, it's like Lierre Keith says that one of the problems with the left is the left has ceded morality to the right. A lot of times on the left, if you talk about morality, that's a bad word, and you're a prude and a pearl clutcher and all sorts of other terrible things. And I agree with Lierre that that's been a terrible, terrible mistake on the left. And it's been very harmful for society. So one of the things that it did is it gave me a good moral compass. And I've certainly modified, you know, in the years that I'm no longer a Seventh-day Adventist, I've modified the moral compass. I've grown, but I still have one. That's one thing. And the other thing that I loved about it was that every Friday night at sundown to Saturday night at sundown, we couldn't do, I don't want to say secular things, because secular for me includes the world, and we were out in nature all the time on Saturdays. And so it was a day where we couldn't do commerce. You know, you can't go shopping, couldn't watch any TV, couldn't read, like non-nature novels. So I couldn't read a thriller or something. And so it was a day I couldn't, and this set me apart from all my fellow students in elementary school. I had no idea what they were talking about with the Saturday morning cartoons. And I'm delighted, you know, in retrospect, Saturday was a
you
day.
You didn't miss much.
I'm sorry, what?
You didn't miss much.
Saturday was a day where it was a day of rest and a day of, and it's a, I wish I had the gumption is the word probably, to just do that on my own now and just take one day off a week to not, you know, do whatever. And so it's, and now to take it to larger environmental scale, I completely agree that that's a wonderful thing to do, to let the land rest. That's incredibly good advice. Now that I blathered on like that, can you say what you meant by a missed opportunity?
Yeah. So there's a couple of aspects here. So first of all, I think because people on the right and on the left start with different axioms, they'll often say things, they'll talk past each other. So for example, all too often you can look to those evangelicals or those fundamentalists that consume too much. They drive the big trucks, you know, they're always buying and selling. But then you can say, in my general experience, is it's more difficult to get somebody to fundamentally change how they view the world than it is to get them to admit that their worldview already has some of the same values that yours does.
Wait, say that again. It's easier.
It's easier to convince somebody that their worldview already has some of the same overlapping values that yours does, rather than having them to change their worldview entirely.
Completely agree.
And so what I would say is that since the Bible has this rich Jubilee Sabbath language and culture in it, which includes giving the land rest, that's one way that the olive branch could be extended by either side to say, hey, look, we have our differences. We don't always get along, but we both agree that this is a good idea. And so, for example, let's say from the point of view of an environmental, say, I think you identify as a bioregionalist in Cascadia. So if bioregionalism, sustainable, you know, living of that nature on one end, with whatever the, you know, a conservative Christian or a conservative person might think is their ideal. If we all agree, can you just imagine if we all agreed not to buy or sell for one day a week? That'd be 52 days out of the year, commerce stops. That's still a big win, even if it doesn't get you all the way to occupied Cascadia. Being liberated.
I don't disagree with you at all. And the problem is, how do you... See, this has to do with that moral compass I was mentioning earlier, that when you had a society run by, I mean, if you had an entirely Jewish society or an entirely Seventh-day Adventist society, that'd be a piece of cake, because everybody would have this imperative. And if you had, there are lots of other reasons you could have this, but I can just see talking to a farmer and saying, you know, one year out of every seven, you have to not plant any corn. And he's going to go and he's going to say, how am I going to pay my mortgage? And I don't. So I guess the summation of my, I agree with you. I think it's a great idea. The problem is that at this point, neither Christianity nor a land ethic are the primary ethics running society. Right now, it's the capitalist production model.
I would agree with that as well. But I guess one way to sort of bookend this point is, one of the things that we learn from both military history, any sort of competition, sporting, whatever, small outnumbered groups can punch above their weight if they're organized. And so what I'm saying is the divide and conquer strategy that, for lack of a better word, the globalist elite is using, right. If we could overcome that by sort of trying to rediscover a shared language, that could then maybe be the first steps to building an organization that could punch above its weight. Or at least a better word would be a culture. A culture in a society that could punch above its weight.
Have you heard my story about the time I was getting firewood and the logger fixed my flat tire?
No, we got to hear this.
Okay, story. Excuse me. So early 90s. Excuse me. I live in Spokane, and I drive out in the national forest to get firewood from the slash piles. You know, they got slash piles. I throw it in the back of the truck and drive on down. And I'm up there, and I get a flat tire. And so I go to check my spare, and I haven't checked my spare in years. So my spare's flat, of course. And I'm miles back there, so I'm not going to walk out. So I'm driving along on a flat tire at 1 mile per hour, just thump, thump, thump. And I come to this guy's house, and I stop and I say, do you have a pump so I can pump up my spare? He says, no, I don't, but I do have a tire I'll give you. So he gave me a tire, really nice guy. So I put the tire on, and I go home, and I get my tires fixed. And then the next day, my mom makes a cake, and I take him his tire back, and I take the cake. And he says, hey, you want some? I say, sure, it'd be great. So we go inside, and he's got chainsaws all over his wall. And he says, by the way, I got plenty of wood out back. If you want me to cut you some logs to length, I'll throw them in the back of your pickup. I said, that'd be great. Thank you so much. So we walk outside. He's holding a chainsaw, and he says, by the way, what do you do for a living? I say, well, I'm a writer. He said, what do you write? I'm thinking, oh, man, science fiction, fantasy, romance, but I'm a terrible liar, and so I say, well, right now I'm writing a book about how the big four timber companies got their land illegally from the public domain. He starts swearing and turns red in the face. I'm looking for a break in the fence, and it takes me about 20 seconds to realize that he's an independent logger who got put out of business by Plum Creek. He hates him even worse than I do, which I didn't think was possible. And it takes us about another 30 seconds before we got our arms around each other's shoulders, just swapping atrocity stories of Plum Creek. And then we agree that we're going to work together to take down Plum Creek. And then I say, you know, I got to be honest with you. I am against all industrial logging. And after we take out Plum Creek, after we take out Plum Creek, Potlatch, Boise Cascade, and Weyerhaeuser, I'm coming after you. And then he just started laughing. We're both laughing our heads off because taking on Plum Creek is a job of a lifetime. And so my differences with this guy were theoretical and trivial compared to the real problems we face. And like, I've always thought that, and I've had some arguments with animal rights people about this, I've always thought that animal rights people should work with hunters to protect habitat.
Exactly.
Protected. Then the animal rights people can sabotage the hunts. You know, they can fight then. But for now, we agree that we want more habitat. We want it for the animals. You want it for the animals so you can shoot them. That's fine. We'll have that disagreement later. So
Exactly. That's sort of the thinking process that I'm going on with here. And one of the things that I'm sure you've probably experienced. Go ahead.
I'll say one more thing about that, which is I've wondered this for a long time, and I still firmly believe that this is the way to move. This is what politics is. You know, you and I are having this conversation. We probably disagree about a lot of things, but I don't care. Anyway, the point is that I used to feel this really strongly until I encountered, I still feel it strongly, but there's one asterisk we have to put in here, which, and the same could be true for you on the right with some people on the left, I'm sure. Hell, it's the same for me for some people on the left. There are people on the left I won't work with because they're just total jerks. Anyway, I met these two guys one day. I was selling some equipment, and they happened to answer the ad and came out. We chatted for an hour or so, and they were every cliche of nasty, horrible, right-wing, woman-hating, black and Mexican and Jew-hating. It's like I suddenly understood why some people won't work with some people on the right, because these guys were just nasty pieces of work. And the same is true. I found the same is true for some people on the left. But I just wanted to put that in too, that sometimes there are people who do manifest all those terrible cliches that you just can't work with because they're so nasty.
Well, exactly. Now, I don't want to do this too much in the interview, but I think this story illustrates an interesting point. You're probably familiar with the story of David and Bathsheba and Nathan's story of his parable, but I think Nathan's parable is interesting to read. And the Lord sent Nathan to David, and he came to him and said to him, "There are two men in one city, one rich and one the other poor. The rich man had exceedingly many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he had bought and nourished, and grew up together with him and his children. It ate of his own food and drank of his own cup and lay in his bosom, and it was like a daughter to him. And a traveler came to the rich man, who refused to take from his flock and from his own herd to prepare one of the wayfaring men who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. So David's anger was greatly aroused against the man, and he said to Nathan, 'As the Lord lives, the man has done this, shall surely die. And he shall restore fourfold for the lamb, because he has done this thing and had no pity.'" And what I find interesting about that story is, in one way, it sounds very left-wing. It's a guy's got a pet lamb, the rich man comes, doesn't need anything, he just takes from the poor guy because he can't. Now, on the other hand, it sounds right-wing because it's the King David, there's God, and there's judgment. But there's this sort of bridge. There's this sort of bridge there that, yeah, you know, Proverbs 12:10 says the righteous has concern for his animals. Now, what's interesting is you mentioned this in another discussion, that before the nature could be stripped, it had to be violated in one's head. And so, by the same token, giving existence to a thing is the first step in giving rights to a thing. So the fact that Solomon instructs the Israelites to have concern for animals puts them on a moral matrix that they weren't on before. Because you're just not even thinking about them. What do you care? And what's interesting is the law against eating animals with the blood in them, Genesis 9:4. What it does is it's an implicit prohibition against killing animals while eating them while they're alive. So, for example, in China, they'll kill bats for soup by just throwing them into a vat. And in the ancient Roman world, they would roast pigs alive on a spit. This is atrocious. But we see a step in this direction where, look, no, if you have to eat animals, we get that. But you got to do it in a way that's humane. They got to be dead. You can't be carving them up while they're still alive. And so there's two things I'm trying to get at here. One is that even if we have end states that might be incompatible theoretically, we at least have short-term agreements that will take a lifetime to solve. So the theoretical disputes never really develop until long after we're dead. And then the other point is, and this might be a bit, you may or may not agree with this, but I think the Jewish Christian tradition is sort of the wellspring from which what we might call, for lack of a better word, animal rights comes from. Because we look at, this is what's interesting, there's a history of hunting in England. It was called Blood Sport by Emma Griffin. And on page 86, or was it? Yeah, 86, she says, or 85. "The Puritans were the first to articulate a consistent and coherent attack on cruelty to animals, a distinction that has rarely been acknowledged by generations of hostile critics." And I think that's very interesting that it's these sort of, for lack of a better word, fundamentalists for their own time, the Puritans, are the first people that articulate. Now, their articulation is based off of God's law, not what you might argue is the intrinsic dignity of the animal as a part of nature. But regardless of where it came from, this is where the idea comes from.
So I have a bunch of responses. One of them is, you know, this is that moral compass idea I was talking about earlier, that you can't talk about, for example, the slavery abolition movement without talking about Christianity. Christianity was used by the Southerners by pro-slavery philosophers to rationalize slavery, and Christianity was used by the abolitionists. I mean, it was a very strong motivator for a lot of them. I mean, like I said, you can't talk about abolition without talking about Christianity because it was so central to all of that. And I completely agree with what you were saying earlier about this being a huge lost opportunity. And that's one thing I wanted to say. Another is, you know, these disagreements, yes, the theoretical disagreements, like I'm presuming that you're against pornography. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. So, gosh, I can't work with you because you're Christian, even though we're both against pornography.
Exactly.
That's
bizarre.
That has always seemed just completely absurd to me. And then the other thing is some of our disagreements we can just put them on hold because, you know, it doesn't really matter why we think, it doesn't matter that we might have different motivations for not liking pornography or for thinking that it's not okay to boil an animal alive. We might have different motivations, but it doesn't matter. I agree with you on that. And then the other thing is there's places we disagree probably that if we were in a long-term campaign together would be not only, you know, I just did an interview yesterday, and one of the things I was saying in the interview was that biodiversity brings resilience to an ecosystem. And I don't like calling them ecosystems because that's machine language, to a natural community, to a forest. And, you know, if you have, like there's the passenger pigeon louse, a lice, that lived only on passenger pigeons. And when the passenger pigeon went extinct, that louse went extinct too because it only had one food supply. And if you have multiple food supplies in tough times, things are going to be easier. And why doesn't that same thing apply to our movements? That if we have a movement that is diverse in terms, and not diverse for its own sake, but simply diverse because you're against porn for this reason, I'm against porn for this reason, and it seems to me that that's better because you can talk to one person better than I can. I can probably talk to another person better than you can. And then another part of this is if we were in a long-term campaign together on something or a long-term relationship of some sort, you know, I have a problem with the whole notion of a sky god and God being out there as opposed to inherent in every needle of every pine tree. And I mean, this is the whole Hegelian thing. We have thesis, antithesis, synthesis. I mean, that's the whole point is we, presumably, if we were going to have, you know, many long discussions in front of a fireplace, we would come to areas of agreement on this sky god thing and areas of agreement on I don't even think it would be that big of a stretch because you can say, well, the god's out there and the god is also right there too. That's a pretty easy synthesis of that. But the point is that even those differences of opinion, at the very least, they help us to hone our own arguments. You know, a lot of my books have consisted of somebody writes me a note saying, you're an idiot because you said this and this and this. And then I spend the next 4 days fuming and constructing arguments in my head for why I'm not an idiot. And then I go, huh, that would work pretty well in a book. And it makes the argument because they threw this argument at me.
Well, exactly. So, for example, we can also look at how not just Christian conservatives, because I don't think Roger Scruton would be considered a religious person of any stripe. He died recently. But think of some of the greatest conservative thinkers of the present day. Roger Scruton, Tolkien, C.S. Lewis. Tolkien and Lewis in their fiction Everybody knows the Ents had destroyed Isengard, the center of industrial civilization in Middle-earth. And even in the Chronicles of Narnia, the trees are alive and the Narnians protect the trees. So it isn't like, on the one hand, the left cares about the environment and nobody on the right does. And that's one thing that I think that needs to be broken down, because it's harmful to both sides.
I think, and I'm certainly guilty of this too, I think it's really easy to turn those you disagree with into caricatures. And I think, have you read Martin Buber's I and Thou?
No, I have not.
Oh, great, great book. I love that book. Basically, the thesis is that there's two types of relationships. It should be translated as IU, not I thou, because it's more informal. There's IU, where I perceive the other as a subject, and there's I it, where I perceive it as an object. And one of the points he makes is that IU is obviously an interpersonal relationship, and I it, you're objectifying them. But he also doesn't sort of fetishize IU, in that he says you can't go your whole life perceiving every other person as a subjective being at all times. You know, I have to go into town later today, and when I'm at the grocery store, I would explode if I perceived the individuality of every person coming down the food aisle. It's like, I can't take all that in. My brain isn't big enough. And so we have to objectify sometimes, but the problem is that we objectify too often and we make people into caricatures, often for political reasons.
Well, let me also put it in this perspective. So the homogenization of everything is the result of empire, whether it's, you know, the corporate empire or states. And I always find it humorous or ironic that anti-imperialists on the left think that when they defeat the empire, everybody in the world is going to have exactly the same values that they do. But since they since they're anti-imperialists, well, it's difficult to imagine how everybody in the world could be just like them. And isn't that, in some sense, internalizing imperialism as a mental category?
Absolutely. I mean, it's like the whole melting pot theory. Is our melting pot image is inherently, a form of consumption. It's inherent in the technologies. Ever since mass technology has really taken over, dialects are disappearing and accents are disappearing some, and
food strains.
Foods. Yeah, I completely agree.
So I have a question. This is not something that I would be really, if you were, say, a Bronze Age agricultural community and you gave the land a year's rest, what would we expect to see happen on the ground?
See, I like the Jubilee idea. The problem I have with it is that, it's only allowing, I'm trying to think of the neutral term for this. It allows pioneer species only to come back. Because in 1 year, you're only going to get the species who come in over degraded soil. You're not going to get the species who who are later succession. You're only going to get early succession plants and animals. And, I keep thinking, I used to be a commercial beekeeper in my 20s and 30s, and a saying among beekeepers is that bees get 90% of their forage from 10% of the land. And what that was basically is fence rows, because they can't plow or mow next to a fence row. And so you'll get flowers blooming there all summer. And so I like the Jubilee idea, and I would like to extend it to, so the land is given 1 year of rest every 7 years. In addition, 1/7 of the land is never touched. I would want to add that as a modern. Okay.
Interesting. Because one of the other interesting elements that I found coming out of the documentary Occupied Cascadia is Charles Epstein, and he's giving this vignette about the collapse of civilization. And he's like, look, when civilization collapses, gold won't have any value. So what are you going to have to put your value in? You're going to put your value into other people. So instead of saving up all this gold for the end of civilization where you can't eat it, and people probably just take it from you anyhow, because, you know, you're going to be all isolated and able to protect it. It reminded me of the parable of the steward that got fired in Luke 16. He forgave everybody's debts in order to find a place to go after he got fired. And then Jesus says, make friends with unrighteous mammon. So in case you run into hard times, you can then build a relationship. It's the same concept. And I thought it was very interesting that from these two different perspectives, we were getting at a similar concept.
You know, that's the thing is, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that one of the things that I think we're both getting at is that the important thing is the wisdom itself, and it's secondary where it comes from. And so the wisdom can come from the Bible. It can come from a traditional communal story. It could come from some other, you know, have you read much Joseph Campbell? Do you like him, dislike him? What do you think about him? Or do you not?
I don't know who Joseph Campbell is, unfortunately.
Okay, Joseph Campbell wrote this book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And he also was a big deal discussing mythology. He wrote The Hero with a Thousand Faces in the 40s, I believe. And then, there was a big Bill Moyer special where he interviewed him several times and that boosted his popularity again in the late 70s, early 80s. And Joseph Campbell's big deal is that his book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, is basically the working title was How to Read a Fairy Tale. And all of these stories are stories on how to live. And that's what, you know, he influenced me very profoundly. And this, you know, sort of my definition of a religion, what a religion is supposed to do, a religion is supposed to, and you can, I mean, you probably think about religion more than I, so maybe you can correct me on this. But I think the purposes of a religion are to, in no particular order, help us to live on the land, to help us to live in our community, and to help us to experience the divine. And there are different ways that, so it doesn't matter to me whether Jesus was a real person or whether he was a mythological figure. At this point, it doesn't matter to me, because what's important is those were stories that resonated so much that they came through till today, and we can. I just read this terrible book. Jim Harrison he just died a couple years ago. He was a sort of modern literature person. And in this book, the protagonist is a 65-year-old retired detective who made a hole in his wall so he can peep on his naked 16-year-old neighbor. And whenever I read any novel, whenever I watch any TV show, whenever I read any nonfiction book, whenever I always think, what is this teaching me about being a human being? What is this teaching me about how to live? And so I come back to the left having lost morality. That book that I just read, that novel I just finished the other day, is profoundly immoral. And it teaches people to live the wrong way. And this is something that, what point am I trying to make? The point I'm trying to make is that.
Well, maybe to answer your question, what I would say is, I'm not even getting that far with this discussion over whether it matters, whether the core principle is true or not. I do believe that that is very important. But what I'm merely getting at now is that there are multiple opportunities for constructive discussions, and possibly tactical alliances, which are not being explored because of this miscommunication. We're not, and that's really all I'm getting at the moment right now. And I feel like that if we were to have more discussions like this, unfortunately we're almost out of time and I wanted to cover technology and all that. So maybe we'll have to do that later. I don't know, Derek. That's up to you.
Well, I completely agree. I completely agree with what you're saying. And I was, however ineptly, trying to make the same point. That's why I was saying, for the purposes of the point I was trying to make, it doesn't matter whether Jesus was a real person or not, because the important thing is that story is wisdom that can teach me how to live and can teach you how to live. And there are ways, so we don't even have to, I was, again, ineptly saying, trying to say the same thing you said much better, which is that there's wisdom, and that's all. I mean, it's just.
Yeah, I have a question. This is something that I'd be interested in getting your feedback on. If we look at those civilizations and societies whose moral consciousness did not at some point pass through the Jewish-Christian tradition of the Bible, what would you say that their treatment of animals in practice is? Now, let me bookend this discussion. Savitri Devi, a sort of Hindu white mystic in India, was a friend of Gandhi. And she had a lot of the same bodhisattva beliefs that Gandhi had. And she said, she was a vegan environmentalist, and she said to Gandhi, why do your people treat animals so badly? Doesn't the Hindu scriptures say that, all life is sacred? He's like, well, yeah, then I wouldn't have a movement if I told him that. And so she was kind of like, wow, how can you do that? And so while on paper the Hindu scriptures might say those things, in that particular context, Gandhi was like, well, I can't really do much about the actual brass tacks on the ground. And I just wonder, would you say that in those parts of the world where the moral consciousness was not informed by the Torah and the New Testament, are animals treated better or worse?
It's really, I can't say. And the reason I can't say is because there are tens of thousands of different cultures. And there was the Talua culture right here. And then there's the Yurok culture, which is a little bit down there. And some of these cultures treated animals pretty well. And some of these cultures were pretty horrific to animals, to humans. It's human culture really spans a wide... It has taken on almost unimaginable variety of forms. And even the Hindu thing, I was interviewing this guy a couple weeks ago, who is one of the, world's experts on snakes in India. And I didn't know this, but 50,000 people die every year from snake bites in India. And that's a lot. And he educates people as to what they can do to prevent these snake bites. And one of the questions I asked him was, do people in India hate snakes the way people in the Western United States hate wolves, for example? He said, no, not at all. That's actually the easiest part of this, that I don't have to convince people to not hate snakes because snakes, and I'm not saying that people in India treat other animals well, but according to this guy, they treat snakes pretty well. And so all he has to do is tell them to wear like boots when they go out in the rice paddies. It's technical stuff. Take a flashlight when you go outside to go to the bathroom at night, because so you don't step on one that bites you. So there's that instead of having to convince the people not to hate snakes. So even within the Hindu culture, there is, my understanding from talking to this one guy, not a hatred of snakes. So it's all over the map. It really is. I would not be comfortable. I would not be comfortable asserting that all animal rights comes from the Judaic tradition. I am sure, well, maybe the animal rights because of the notion of rights, but.
Well, I'm speaking merely in a sort of historical or genealogical sense. If we sort of pinpoint in human history where an organized body of thought that's self-generating begins, where, within the radical Protestant tradition, there's always been opposition to hunting and unnecessary cruelty to animals. And I think in part of that is because mediating the interpretation of the scripture in other denominations is these hierarchical institutions often allied to empires. And so that's going to color how they read it. Whereas if you're sort of a, for lack of a better word, anti-authoritarian, they wouldn't have seen themselves as such, but for lack of a better word, I think it's descriptively useful. They had this tradition of animals have some intrinsic value and you just can't do whatever you want with them, like hunt them for sport or torment them in bear fights.
Well, there were, I know among different peoples, there were always restrictions that some creatures were taboo to kill among traditional indigenous peoples. I remember reading that if a guy killed a buffalo out of season among the Lakota, that they would break all his weapons. And I mean, there were very strong strictures against killing buffalo at the wrong time of year. And so my point is, and that didn't come from Judaic tradition. I think wisdom can come from many different means. And wisdom, in my experience, comes primarily from communally living in place and learning what a land ethic comes from living in place over time and learning what the land does and doesn't can and cannot afford.
Yeah. I think, unfortunately, we're almost out of time. So what I would like to end with, and then I'll let you have the closing statements, is that from the perspective that you or Lier Keith would come from, it's not entirely self-evident that the Bible doesn't have a land ethic. In fact, I think it does. It has, at least with the Jubilee and the Sabbath and other rules, a sort of germ or a core that is a land ethic. So in short, we're not necessarily your enemies.
So I don't disagree with that at all. And I'm thinking of the movie The Ruling Class. Did you ever see that? It's 1972.
No. Mm-mm.
It's about this guy. Okay, it's going to sound blasphemous, but I don't think it is. It's about this guy who, this English lord dies, and his son inherits the position, and his son thinks that he is Jesus Christ. He's crazy. And he goes around. It's pretty smart conceit, because now he can go around and preach. He's giving a lot of Christian messages. And then everybody thinks that's crazy, because he's preaching that you should be nice to each other and not, you know, be nasty, and you should love one another. And of course, everybody thinks that's insane. It's a terrible critique, or strong critique of society. And so I'm gonna go ahead and ruin it. So anybody who doesn't want to hear the end of the story, just plug your ears for the next 20 seconds. So they cure him, and what they do is they basically turn him into Jack the Ripper. Now he enters the House of Lords. He's now a respected member of society, and he's horrible. And it's basically what I was talking about earlier with this movement from a morality, not a morality, but from a space morality to an immoral society, or a society with no morals whatsoever. And why did I bring all that up? Oh, because at one point in one of the speeches that the character gives, he says, you know, my mistake last time is I spoke in parables, because I don't think people get it. And I remember laughing really hard when I heard that line, because yes, parables are very important. Storytelling is how we learn. But the point I'm getting at is that the same point I made early on, I don't disagree that there can be a land ethic found in in the Bible at all. The problem, or one of the problems, is that if humans can interpret greed is good as a good statement instead of a bad one, people can misinterpret stuff all over the place. And as you know, the Bible was used to support slavery. It's like, oh, for crying out loud. So there is a land ethic in there, and we can also, and you know, another person you might be interested in learning a little bit more about, I find him very interesting, is David Ehrenfeld, who wrote this great book called The Arrogance of Humanism. And Ehrenfeld is really, really interesting because he desperately cares for the natural world. He was the head of the American Society of Conservation Biologists, or whatever the association is called. And he's also a practicing Orthodox Jew, which I find really, I mean, it's, he would completely agree with everything you're saying in terms of a land ethic emerging from the, especially Old Testament. And I don't know, I'm just rambling. I think it can be done, and I think it's, I completely agree with you that there are tremendous missed opportunities, and we don't have to agree. So, and you don't have to say, but are you any particular, like I said, I was Seventh-day Adventist when I was a kid. Do you follow any particular group? Like, are you Catholic? Are you?
I would say the group that I most closely identify with today are the Anabaptists from the Radical Reformation of the 16th century.
Huh. Well, good thing you didn't live in the 17th or 16th centuries.
That's true. It's been a great conversation, Derek, but I'm sorry we have to wrap this up. So this is Todd Lewis of the Prayers of Folly podcast signing off.